The session is entitled Doing Time with St. Ambrose and St. Augustine. And I'm taking one question from each of those two bishops so as to continue the series that we're doing this week. The question from St. Ambrose is, why do the injuries of nature delight you? We'll revisit the question and the context in a moment. The question from St. Augustine is, question from St. Augustine is, why do you infest the earth? Now, the trick at Holden, from the point of view of teaching staff, is always to create sessions where each session is a unit unto itself. Because people come and people leave and people hike and people have lots of choices. So each session needs to be able to stand on its own. At the same time, there's a theme. And so the sessions should be put together in such a way that they connect with one another and where, when possible, build upon one another. What's been happening in this series this week in Christian ethics and more specifically on earth-honoring faith is that I've started two conversations. One conversation is a conversation with the primal elements themselves, earth, air, fire, water, trying to put them at the center of the moral universe and in the life of faith, because we live on a planet in jeopardy at human hands. And we need to know what the claims of the primal elements, they're the parental generative elements of life, what those claims have upon us when our cumulative activity is so impacting of Earth that the scientists have said are entering a new geological age, the Anthropocene age. So that's one conversation. What do we learn if we listen to the wise rock and the singing river and the tree of life? And we've done a session on water and we've done a session on soil. The other conversation is one focused on the resources of our faith and the faiths of others that might give us a place to stand, to see and to address the earth-destructive side of our way of life. Can we draw from our own wells of our faith traditions in such a way that we have resources with which to reform, transform our way of life so that it is not, on balance, destructive in the community of life of which we are a part? So, see if there is some wisdom then in the traditions. So those are the two conversations this week. And the one today belongs to the second conversation of looking at the wisdom that has preceded us, usually wisdom that is helpful for changing a way of life. Is wisdom that comes from the edges of society or the bottom of society. It comes from people who have already experienced the downside of a way of life and who have some knowledge of what the dynamics are that make for this underside of a way of life. The other source of wisdom, that's sort of in the present, that you look to those sources. Or you can look to them in the past, too. But the other source of wisdom is to look to past traditions, those of another time and place and culture and faith. They're outside, maybe, the paradigm that we're operating with, and because they're outside of it, they offer us angles of vision that we don't come to on our own, because we're already looking at the world through lenses that we're very comfortable with and we're much at home with. What about the folks who lived in times where they were part of a different way of life and a different way of seeing things? What can they offer to us? So there's a retrieval that needs to go on there. Next week I'm going to get into those in some depth. But today we're going to pick two people whose world was not ours. And that's precisely the advantage they may have for us in providing a different angle. It's a little bit in keeping with Albert Einstein's contentions that you can't solve the problems you face with the same frame of mind that produced them. You've got to find some other frame of mind, some other mentality, some other lenses by which you view them if you're going to address them well. And maybe St. Ambrose and St. Augustine are some of the sources. Now, so these two questions then are questions that I hope will help us collectively get some insight into why it is that our way of life has placed the planet in jeopardy at human hands. What is it that creates that kind of injury? Now, there are enormous benefits, and much of parts of nature are far better off than they were. But on balance, that is not the case. And maybe we can get some help from elsewhere. I put some possible answers to those questions. Why do the injuries of nature delight you? Why do you infest the earth? On the board here, but I want us to brainstorm as to what we think results in that kind of downside of the way we live. And one of them that I'm sure comes from these two bishops of the late 4th and early 5th century of the Common Era has to do with the way in which privilege and power rig the game. Now, their angle on that in the Roman Empire is an angle that focuses on intrahuman privilege and power, the exercise of privilege and power within human society, but with ramifications for nature, since you can't have a human society that isn't embedded in nature and that doesn't have consequences for the rest of nature. In fact, that society is always a part of nature. So, intrahuman privilege and power gets at factors such as race, class, gender, culture. Those are all factors in privilege and power that's intrahuman. They didn't spend a whole lot of time, mostly because the human species didn't exercise such a large role among the forces of nature as ours. But I want us to see if they've got any insights for us on species privilege and power. Augustine and the Reformation traditions are pretty good on laying out the dynamics of sin. They're not very good on talking to us about species sin. And so I want us to talk about species privilege and power. And again, there may be positive results of occupying the place we do now as a species, affecting the core surface processes of the planet. There may be many destructive elements, so let's take a look at species privilege and power. Then I put a couple of others up here that might explain why the injuries of nature delight us and why we infest the earth. It may be the depth of empathy. We'll talk about that. But lots of human beings in the modern era don't have any true empathy, feeling for other than human nature, with the exception of their pets and a few houseplants. Their gardens, yes. But where the wild things are, doesn't much matter. Much less a kind of feeling for being creatures of the soil or being creatures of the water. The primal elements themselves that are parental for life itself. So maybe it's the death of empathy. Nyla and I live in the southwest. The Pueblo and Indian peoples who have lived there 1,000 years on or very near the same lands have always thought of themselves as creatures of soil, where the spirits also of the animals are shared with them, with their spirit. Their circle of empathy doesn't stop at the boundaries of the human community. In fact, the border line is so porous that they can't talk about themselves without talking about the rest of nature. So maybe it's that. We'll talk about that. Maybe it's because human beings have been about creating a simpler world than the world that nature, the rest of nature, provides. Maybe it's because our brains are too small. maybe it's because we've got crimped tarts. That's Luther thought that was the problem. Maybe there's a kind of bias that comes with being human that explains this. So that's what we want to get into. And again, this is the start of a list. You may have other nominations for explaining why the planet is in jeopardy at human hands. What I will do is provide a context for these two figures, Ambrose and Augustine, just enough so that you know where their questions are coming from and what their start to the answer to their own questions looks like. And then we'll go from there to our situation and ask whether their insights may carry on for us, or whether it's something else. So again, this is the session to answer their questions, not necessarily as they would, but as we must. Now, Ambrose raised this question about the distress of Earth in Milan, which was the temporary capital of the Roman Empire, because Rome was under siege at that time. Incidentally, I can provide you the sources here, but if you want to look at recent books about Ambrose and Augustine in a wonderful review of those books, it's Peter Brown, who is kind of the biographer of Augustine. I mean, he's one of many, but one of the best-known biographies of Augustine is by Peter Brown. And he's the reviewer of 6 recent books on Ambrose and Augustine and John Chrysostom in the East. Chrysostom is a Greek father of the same period, and Augustine and Ambrose are the Latin fathers. It's a tale of two bishops and a brilliant saint in the New York Review of Books. That's what the NYRB stands for. March 8th of this year. But I can give you more details if you want more details. So this is Milan. This is Milan, the end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century. Ambrose, because it's also serving now as the capital of the Roman Empire, finds himself both Bishop of Milan and the Emperor's bishop. He had also served as a governor of the province. So he's well connected in governing circles. And here is his question. Why do the injuries of nature delight you? The world has been created for all, while you rich are trying to keep it for yourselves. Not merely the possession of the earth, but the very sky, air, and the sea are claimed for the use of the rich few. Not from your own do you bestow upon the poor person, but you make return from what is his. For what has been given as common for the use of all, you appropriate for yourselves alone. The earth belongs to all, not to the rich. Oh, that's his complaint in the 4th century. Ambrose was the teacher of Augustine. Augustine is a Berber from North Africa. He went back after coming to Ambrose. He came to Milan looking for work. He was a professor, teacher of rhetoric there. He was very moved by the preaching of Ambrose, and he asked to be baptized, and Ambrose baptized him. If you go to Milan, you can still see the baptismal font where Ambrose baptized Augustine. And one of his books is reviewed, there's a book by Gary Wills on about that font. So Augustine then, being baptized, becomes the bishop of Hippo. So he returns to North Africa. Hippo is in what is now modern Algeria. Many of the great early Christian theologians are Africans, they're Roman Africans. Augustine is one of them, Origen's another one, Cyprian's another. But and the Berbers are still around. So go to Algeria and chat with the Berbers. Augustine had a notion at that time, until his coming under the influence of Ambrose, of a what we call a Manichaean world. The world is divided into opposing spheres of good and evil. And earth and the world belong to the sphere of evil that is opposed to the God of the good. Now, Augustine gives that up. It isn't a materially evil world and opposed to a spiritually good world. That notion hangs around for a long time, but Augustine gives it up. And Augustine, like Ambrose, now understands redeemed creation, redeemed earth, to be the alternative to this cosmic dualism of spiritual good and material evil. It's an alternative. And in his commentaries on Genesis, Augustine, in this particular case, a third commentary in Genesis, he writes that paradise has always been hidden within the earth since creation. Like, I'm quoting here, seeds waiting for the light of justice and mercy. The world, when justice and mercy shine, is, a nice phrase from Augustine, a smiling place. So, paradise is here. This planet. But it will not show itself until justice and mercy reign. Then it will be a smiling place. But Augustine shared with his teacher, Ambrose, suspicions of the imperial rich and their treatment of earth. And in the City of God, book written about upon his return home to Africa after he becomes the Bishop of Hippo, he reflects on the bitter experience of empires without justice and mercy. And he asks rhetorically, remove justice And what are kingdoms but gangs of criminals on a large scale? He goes on to say that the ranks of the demoralized themselves in the empire are the source of many recruits for the empire, who in turn acquire territory, capture cities and subdue peoples and the land for the rewards that then get parceled out by the imperial power, by their leader. The grand title of kingdom is then conferred, Augustine says, clothing all of this in majesty. He adds the caveat that the title is conferred not by renouncing aggression, but by attaining impunity. So if you've got a kingdom, and you clothe it in majesty, but you it isn't because you renounced aggression, force, coercion, but because you found a way to be immune from committing, from the consequences of committing. He clinches his point by borrowing from Cicero, Roman philosopher, an exchange from Cicero. For it was a witty and a truthful rejoinder, which was given by a captured pirate to Alexander the Great. The king asked the fellow, Alexander asked the fellow, what in your is your idea in infesting the sea? And the pirate answered with uninhibited insolence, the same as yours, as infesting the earth. But because I do it in a tiny craft, I'm called a pirate. Because you have a mighty armor, you're called an emperor. So Augustine says, you know, why do you, borrowing from Cicero, why do you invest the earth? What's the source of this imperious behavior on your part? Both of these bishops are cozy with empire. They're sharp critics of society, of the empire, but they're cozy with it. And Ambrose, in fact, excommunicated, and he's in high ranks, as I mentioned, he was a governor of the province, he's now the bishop for the emperor. But he excommunicated Emperor Theodosius after Theodosius ordered a massacre in Thessalonica in retaliation for the murder there of one of his guards. Guard was murdered and Theodosius came down hard and ordered the massacre. The bishop withheld the Eucharist from the emperor, telling him that either he must publicly repent or renounce his baptism and leave the community. Yeah. Well, only after Theodosius underwent the rites of repentance for 8 months, fasting, almsgiving, and this was probably the worst, worshiping in plain clothes alongside other penitents, could the emperor again be rejoin the community for the Eucharist. So, had some power there himself. For his part, Augustine rejects Eusebius's fawning account of Constantine and the empire. This is the Constantinian empire, rather early on. And Eusebius is a historian of this period who has this very laudable fawning account of the empire, where the empire is a kind of Christianized earthly paradise. In which Christ, with the help of Constantine's sword, triumphs over his enemies. For Augustine, as for Ambrose, redeemed earth as paradise is the alternative to empire. Paradise was not, contra Rome's claims, an embodiment of the empire. Paradise was an alternative to the empire. The city of God, imperfectly expressed through the church, was the critic and the judge of imperial power, the city of man. And that's the language there. Okay, one last thing. What moves Ambrose and Augustine to, even though they're cozy with Empire, to denounce the injustice of corporate privilege? What fuels their courage to stand as they do against imperial power, despite their own presence in its corridors of power? They're not a fringe group. They're not at the edges themselves. They benefit from Empire. On one level, we might surmise there is simply the moral divide between what is and what ought to be, and they're felt responsible to address moral gaps rather than be complacent about the difference between is and what ought to be. Hope has two lovely daughters, anger and courage. Anger that what is ought not to be, courage that what ought to be might be, is a line from Augustine. The two lovely daughters of hope are anger and courage. But there's a deeper reason, a reason that renders this gap between is and ought itself unacceptable, and that generates hope together with anger and courage. Neither bishop can give up on the biblical dream for the earth. The biblical dream for the earth is justice, community, and the common good, with righteousness as a good life lived in good institutions. Neither can imagine the common earthly good as anything less than the minimal livability necessary so that the individual good of every creature can be pursued. Thus, neither one of them can stifle the prophet's anger as at creation violated and the earth desecrated at human hands. Some humans far more than others, that's their point about the rich and poor. Neither can imagine that the earth has not been given as common for the good of all, Ambrose, or that Eden might not be reborn, that's Augustine's prayer. The biblical dream for creation is what drives their action. Yet the haunting question for me is still, you know, why do the injuries of nature delight you? Or why do you infest the earth? Why the killing and the harming of human animals, of other animals, of trees and plants, of bodies of water, mountain valleys, tailings? Such destruction is the outcome of human choice and agency. It is a matter of human moral responsibility. So what's behind it? we're going to this now. I'm just going to add an exchange that many of you already know if you've read the delightful account by Daniel Quinn in his fanciful novel called Ishmael. You know this little work? That's some years ago now. But a gorilla by the name of Ishmael in the zoo becomes teacher to a disillusioned young man whose hopes for a transformed world have all but expired. The guy started out an idealist, ends up being very cynical. His idealism has just been pummeled by too much reality. He's as demoralized by injustice and unhappiness as the citizens of empires without justice, and Augustine's talk of the demoralized recruits. Ishmael initiates an exchange with this young man. Well, the gorilla is talking to the young man. Ishmael thought for a moment, among the people of your culture, which want to destroy the world? Which want to destroy it? As far as I know, no one specifically wants to destroy the world. And Ishmael. And yet you do destroy it, each of you. Each of you contributes daily to the destruction of the world. Yes, that's so. Why don't you just stop? All right. Why don't we just stop? That's a question, people. This is a genuine question. I don't even want Ambrose's and Augustine's questions to be accusatory questions. I want them to be genuine questions. Why the destruction? Not as an accusation, but as a question seeking an explanation.
Addictions are hard to overcome.
Now, what kind of addictions, though?
Pot?
No, but I mean, what's the addiction that's hard to overcome? Addiction. Yeah, or the addiction.
Control.
Control. And I suppose, to an extent, every species wants to have some kind of control, or at least be responsive in a way that lets them continue. Now,
I really wish my husband wasn't in here because I wanted to hide my bookstore purchases from him. I didn't have any bags. So the first thing I bought was the story of stuff.
I see.
Yeah. Then I had to buy a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, right.
I love books. And,
right.
And
the story of stuff will tell you not to buy all that.
Yeah,
stuff.
I know. And I just had to. Sorry.
Okay, stuff. And maybe that's one of the addictions. I'm not accusing you, Nancy, of that addiction. But and on Monday I want to talk about asceticism and consumerism, notions of the simple life and religious traditions, as a voice in conversation with consumerism as a way of life. But I think that we may have put our way of life together as one of privilege and power with no intention whatsoever of being destructive of nature. But we've now put it together in such a way that if we don't keep this kind of economy going, there is great suffering. So it may not be a matter of motive. No, if Ishmael says, why don't you just stop? You say, oh, I'm sorry. I won't buy anything anymore. Everybody try doing that and we're all unemployed. Yeah. So that may be the way privilege and power are operating in such a way. I don't know if Ambrose's language is exactly right. It isn't that we delight in the injuries. It may be that we commit those injuries without much knowledge even of them. Where did the food that we had for lunch, such as it was, come from? What do we know about the people who raise quinoa in South America? What do we know about the food that we import and bring so far to the tables and use a whole lot of energy in the process? What do we know about the consequences of that? So we have the essence of any kind of commodity is that it's convenient for our use without burdening us. We don't need to know where it comes from and what the consequences were. It's not part of it. And that may be the way we've rigged privilege and power. Okay, other dimensions on privilege and power or answers to these questions that we've focused. You folks up above, the light is such that you just have to speak up because I can't see. Yeah.
I've read that book. I've memorized a quote out of it.
Ishmael or Ishmael. The City of God?
Ishmael.
Okay.
And I memorized the quote because I think it sums up something that's even more fundamental than the question you're asking about why is it that way. And the premise of the book is there's takers and leakers.
Yes.
And the quote is, and I'm quoting Ishmael and the student here, Ishmael said, "We know what happens when we take the taker position, that the earth belongs to man." And the student answers, "Yes, that's a disaster." And Ishmael says, "And what if we take the leader position, that man belongs to the earth?" And Ishmael says, "Then creation goes on forever." Huh. And the teacher, and Ishmael says, or the student said that. And then Ishmael says, "How does that sound?" And the student answers, "It has my vote."
Very nice.
And so I think it's fundamental between how you think. Are you a taker or are you a man?
Nice, very nice. And actually, St. Ambrose goes on in the same kind of context with the assertion, which is a biblical one. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And we belong to the earth rather than the earth belonging to us. I mean, receivers rather than takers, or tillers and keepers, not just tillers. To use the Genesis language. Yep. Guy or Rob?
Well, I just want to go back to your Onion book from yesterday.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that we're where we are now because there are so many people, and so we want to feed people, and we use these methods that are more destructive, but they're more productive in some ways.
Yeah. That's a good insight. They are more productive for us. But they may simultaneously be more destructive for that upon which we depend to get them, the benefits in the first place. Yeah, and seven. This Augustine and Ambrose is not on their screen at all. I mean, it can't be. 7 billion people, and what it takes to meet the needs of 7 billion people is something they don't face. They face a lot of poor people because they don't have the technology and the means. They do have the resources, potentially, but they don't have the means to address them. And so it's the kind of privilege that comes by virtue of your power in the community of life, with the power at your hands. And this is a really, really tough one. Because we all will do what we need to do to meet basic needs. We will strive to do so. How do we do so in a way that we're receivers and not just takers? Yeah, Brian?
I think a big part of it is this kind of mastery, dominion, simplification. If you look at food, I'm not at all convinced that the broad scale five crops for the world is more productive, but it is vastly simpler.
Yes.
In order to get the sort of productivity we get with mass monoculture, you have to work much harder to do that. If you look at, again, with another food analogy, look at what happened to us in the 50s and 60s, where we thought we understood the complexity of food. We can now make food, ready-made, rather than kind of eating vegetables and basic sources. We're going to have all this stuff that's made for us because we understand what good nutrition is, with a really simplistic view of nutrition. I think if you look at every time we as humans try to simplify something, there's an arrogance built in there. And typically nature is always elusive.
That's how I feel. But we're continuing down that road.
Absolutely.
Of simplification. We've been on that road for a long time. I think it's been since the Neolithic revolutions, where you have 95% of our history is as hunter-gatherers. But this small fraction since, about 10,000 to 8,000 BCE to the present, has been the time of settled human societies. Ever since we've gone to settled human societies, we've done our best to kind of cut and paste nature in ways that help us meet our needs. But then with a kind of insight, not least because of modern science and technology of the modern era, we can do that on a scale that wasn't even possible before. And with fossil fuels, as you brought up yesterday, with fossil fuels you can almost do an end run around the necessity of living by the seasons. Because you can produce the energy that can create a human world that can be a world apart from the unbuilt world, so we think. And bypass the requirements of living with the rest of nature as your immediate environment.
Can you
Can I ask to take a pause for a minute? Because I'm getting stuck on the word simplify.
Yeah.
I'm the generation, 'tis a gift to be simple. Yeah. Live simply so others may simply live.
Yeah.
We're not using that simplify.
No. Thanks.
We're using pare it down into pieces that don't reflect the elegance of the system, something like that.
Yeah. The complexity of nature, the way in which nature, as biodiverse, works so as to perpetuate, meet its own needs and perpetuate its own life. That's an enormously complex system. I think it's Peter Raven. You can't make this up, you know. Thomas Berry, Wendell Berry, Peter Raven. Judith Plant, all these people. You just can't make this stuff up. But I think it's Peter Raven that says the human society is to the complexity of the rainforest as the squeak of a mouse is to history of music. So, I mean, there's an enormous complexity at work in any little patch of soil. You know, there's millions and billions of critters there working in ways that nourish that soil and perpetuate that soil. In our bodies, too. I mean, you got 400 species of microbes in your mouth. Say, you haven't even seen your gut. But in your mouth, not 400 microbes, 400 species of microbes in your mouth helping you through the day. No. There's that kind of complexity. But our way of putting together our world is always reducing that complexity. And agribusiness is a kind of example par excellence, where you're going to go into five crops, major food crops, instead of...
I think that word, the reductionist,
is
helpful.
Yeah. Okay, well that's thank you for that, because that's what I was trying to say. When maybe we injure nature and then infest the earth by such reductionist practices that the rest of nature doesn't do. And if you reduce the biodiversity itself, you all also lost the capacity to adapt to changing, and you've lost the capacity actually to create your own. All right. Guy, we never got to you in this.
I was just thinking that Augustine, it's a question of mastery. That Augustine, without having any understanding of biodiversity, sees that will to power among earthly kings as the attempt to make something permanent in a situation where nothing permanent can be made, uh-huh. where everything is under the overarching sovereignty of God that they can't understand. So the diversity here is God's plan for everything, that mere monarchs, mere emperors cannot, over time, make a change.
Yeah, it's another kind of reductionism.
As a faith issue, it seems obvious to me, at least, that there are those who really don't see this as an issue because they oversimplify everything and live within a rather narrow view of things. And those who do understand the issue understand the complexity, but haven't figured out how to simplify it enough so that the common ordinary people can really understand it. And I think that's really an important issue today, so that we can really encourage every human being, and especially those who, from a church standpoint, sitting in the pew, really can understand the issue and embrace it. So
I'll just arrive at what Paul Ricoeur calls a second naivete.
Exactly.
When you understand the complexity, but you can communicate it in a way that doesn't lose that complexity and yet is accessible
to us.
Yeah.
It really speaks to inherently how people who don't understand feel, but they simply can't articulate it and find a way to organize and do something together.
A good place to look for that is in primary school education or people writing children's books. Who understand, those good teachers who understand the complexity of something, say a science project, and are able to communicate it to grade schoolers, they often have a way of getting at this. But it's a task. So that's a little bit on a simpler world as one of the explanations. Let me just say a word about the death of empathy. It's what I mentioned earlier, but I want to get it in front of us. Because I think the one characteristic of the modern world, by which I simply mean the time since the onset of the Industrial Revolution and the industrialization of nature, one way to talk about that is that we suffer by preferring the built habitat that we've now created. The built world, our own built world, we prefer as our primary habitat over the unbuilt world, the rest of nature. And as a consequence, we may have lost a lot of genuine empathy, genuine feelings for nature beyond our attachments to our selections from nature, our pets, our gardens, our houseplants, a favorite recreation spot like Holden Village. I feel so good when I'm out in nature. I don't know where you've been. somehow or another, when I'm out in creation, it's a different place from where I live. In this kind of odd way of putting things together. How do we address it? We address it. One way I address it is I like a screensaver of pristine areas of nature that I'll probably never see. So my computer gives me that experience of nature. But I don't really have there isn't anything in my spirit that is moved, delighted, or with other elements of nature. So we don't note where the meat on the plate comes from. We don't have a sense of what goes on in factory farms and slaughterhouses that produce it. We don't think about the fact that the eggs we're eating are 90% of them are laid by hens living in a space of 7 inches by 7 inches, that they're fed in such a way that if they're for sale and slaughter, to get large chicken breasts, you feed them in such a way that they can't stand up without falling forward, but they haven't any place to go to. Anyway, those realities don't cause sorrow. I mean, if we know about them and if we see them, okay, maybe. But somehow or another, there is a loss of biophilia on our part in the modern world, which is love of creaturely life. And there's a loss of cosmophilia, a loss of the love of the starry skies above us. It's been degraded enough that we confuse our substitutes for the real thing. And we live in our substitutes rather than the real thing. I was giving a seminar at Grosse Ranche in New Mexico. And we spent each evening looking at resources for this seminar on energy and how we live, earth honoring faith. And we were all sitting there watching the DVD, which had some stunning pictures of sunsets and pristine nature. So we all finished. We went outside, and it was dark by then. people said, did you see it? It was a fabulous sunset tonight. No, we were watching it on the... Well, I think that there is a kind of massive loss of empathy in the modern world on the part of a lot of human beings. Because we prefer the built habitat over the unbuilt. I don't know what the proper words are. And unbuilt isn't the right way to describe the rest of nature, but that. Okay, our time is about up, so let me just say what I had in mind for these others. Brains too small and bias is just a way of saying that we're probably put together in ways where, because we can only see a small portion of the world of which we're a part, and can only see a small portion of the consequences of our own activities, we don't have a full picture of what we're doing. We exercise power that has ramifications for people and the land on the other side of the world, but we don't see what those are. And we couldn't take it all in anyway. I mean, we're biased so as to shrink the world to the kinds of lenses, see it through the kinds of lenses we have. That's one reason why we got to get other folks at other times to give you a different angle. Thing. So maybe we infest the earth and injure nature because our brains aren't so great after all. And we have what our son's a psychologist, and if you know this language, we all operate by confirmation biases. We tend to confirm the world that we already are comfortable with in our judgments. Then the Crim Tarts is the one where I think Augustine and Ambrose, as it comes, their insights as they come to us through the Reformation, especially Luther and Calvin, have a great deal to tell us. The heart turned in upon itself. the human condition as the human heart turned in upon itself, I think, is tremendously insightful. It goes like this: we divide our peoples into we's and they's, and we are ranged over against them with norm making firmly in the hands of the collective we. So this has meant that normative whiteness as the basis for judging other races. Or it has meant European and neo-European societies as a basis for judging other peoples and their ways of life, invariably as inferior. Sometimes even savage. Or it has meant Christianity as the measure of true religion. Or it has meant male status as decisive for female. Augustine himself was one who perpetrated that. Or heterosexual as normative for sexual relations. Or the able body as normative for all. So the self-referential we, viewing the world from inside its bubble, takes the measure of they in terms of us, but not them. That's the heart turned in upon itself. And bias and brains too small, you'd have to change the Latin. You'd have to say something like mens turbata inste instead of cor turbatum inste. The mind turned in upon itself complements that we-they phenomenon. And all I'm saying is I think the reformers had tremendous insight in explicating sin
in terms of this we-they dynamic and labeling it as pride. What we have to do is understand that that now is species sin. We are taking the rest of nature and treating it in ways that reflect the bias and the privilege and the power of human beings as a species. And I'm hoping that people, we in the church, can develop this understanding of sin in terms of species sin. Because I think short of that, we'll exercise a kind of privilege and power that doesn't confess our sins against the rest of nature and that perpetuates infestation. It's an imperious, to get back to Augustine and Ambrose. We act imperiously. We act as if the human kind of project is the empire. That needs to be perpetuated rather than redeemed earth and ourselves as receivers that belong to the earth, being redeemed earth as the alternative to empire. Okay, time's up, unless you want to add a couple more things, and I'm also glad to hang around.
Yeah, did you? Well, I just had a comment, and that is, you know, like, even historically, going back as far as you want, even to Augustine, it really boils down to the work of the city, which is politics. The work of the city, the group polis.
Yeah.
And what we've lost is the dialogic component of what I think the framers, in biblical times even, the framers knew to be the essence of the city of God or the new creation, which was dialogue. Not the we, they, the dialogue that comes to common ground in the work of the city, in building the city. And I think we've lost
that dialogue. And another word for that dialogue is genuine democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
The processes of genuine democracy.
Yeah.
I will mention in Folos and the work of the city, I'll just mention one early Christian vision that I think is powerful in this context. And there they were also urban preachers, or became urban preachers, so Paul's letters are all to city churches. But they had a notion, in addition, that complemented polos, and it was oikos. It's the Greek word for home. Yeah, and the oikos vision, it's the root for ecology, economy, and ecumenism. Those three always belong together. And the ecologist is the one who understands the rules of how the oikos, the household, works. In this case, the oikos of God. In fact, the early Christians talked about the oikonomia tou theou, the economy of God, as the economy of the oikos. But that kind of holistic thinking, where ecology, economy, and ecumenics all belong together, is this kind of necessary holistic vision, because the earth is now ecumenical. The earth is oikos. We've got an economy that runs against the grain. The human economy runs against the grain of the economy of nature. Rather than saying all human economic activity must fit within the requirements of the economy of nature. So there are resources here to draw upon. Thank you very much.